I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
This is Trade Guy Scott. This week, Bill and I discuss members of Congress who have concerns with investor state dispute settlement. We also talk about the incident with the Francis Scott Key Bridge, its effect on trade, as well as the WTO action on automotive subsidies and a concern brought by China. These topics and more on today's episode of The Trade Guys.
Hi, Trade Guys. Good to see both of you again twice in a row. It's like Andrew knew it was my birthday this week.
Happy birthday, Tebow. Are you 21?
That's very flattering. My 21st birthday was at the very beginning of COVID, so I feel like I never really turned 21. Or I certainly did not celebrate it the way most people do.
It's not too late to have a party.
I'm trying to make up for it. I did for this one at the very least. That was my 25th, quarter of a century.
Well, in my era, that would have been a significant event, because I think after that, you're not eligible for the draft anymore.
I did not think about it that way. What I had in mind was I can rent a car with much less cost now. So that's exactly what I did the day after. I rented a car to go to Shenandoah.
Yes, that is. It's one of those things that it's not a law, but it's a practice by every single rental car company that 25 is the age, not less.
So. Yes, I think I'm getting to the back end of that where they won't rent to me because I'm too old, but it's pressing.
Well, it didn't make sense to me before I was 25, but now that I am, I'm completely fine with it. Anyway, let's get into our topics. The first one is investor state dispute settlement mechanism. 47 House lawmakers recently wrote a letter to USCRTI and Secretary Blinken arguing for the removal of the settlement mechanism from CAFTA-DR, the Central American Dominican Republic Free Trade Agreement, arguing that it facilitates harmful corporate overreach in emerging economies. So Scott, I know you've done a lot of work on this when you were at CSIS. Why is this a source of controversy? Tell us about it.
Well, wait a minute. First, he's still at CSIS. Don't consign him to the dustbin quite yet.
Yeah, right. It is true that we did a lot of work when I was with the Scholl chair, but I still do have an affiliation. I'm still a trade guy. And the work on investor state dispute settlement for me, or investment policy, began when I was in the corporate world as well. So it's one of these little understood and sort of soft underbelly of trade policy that few members of Congress, few politicians understand it fully or are aware of how it actually works. And over the years, it's been easy to demonize because you can tell a story of the big corporations who come in and throw their weight around with governments. The facts are quite different from the arguments. And in fact, these members of Congress have been opponents of investment protections for so long, one would think they'd be able to get their story straight. When I read the press release, I realized, look, either these things are just useless or they're so powerful they can destabilize economies. Which is it? Okay. And it turns out it's closer to the former. They're specifically attacking the mechanism. It's in Chapter 10 of the Dominican Republic Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA-DR. So that's seven economies involved, including the United States. It's been in force for 20 years. 2004 is when Chapter 10 entered into force. Over that 20-year period, there have been 17 total investment disputes filed. Of those 17, eight have reached a decision. One was settled, so we don't know the terms. We presume both sides were happy. But of the 17 cases over 20 years, eight have reached a conclusion. The government won in six of the eight. The investors won in only two. So it's a pretty low batting average. And while the letter from the members of Congress talks about billions of dollars and destabilizing poor Honduras, the total awards in these two cases where the investor actually won, total award was $32 million, which was about 10% of what was claimed by the investors. Now, the math in DR CAFTA, while there are very few completed cases, fits very closely with the study that we did when I was in Bill's job at CSIS. We looked basically started when these treaties were first signed and looked at all the disputes that had been concluded where there was a panel decision. And what we found is that investors won fewer than half of the time and that the awards, when they did win, were roughly 10% of the claim, so 10 cents on the dollar. Not a great return. Certainly, the panel itself, the arbitration, is worse than a coin toss for the investor. That's certainly the case in the DR CAFTA record. But the thing is, investor protection treaties with our arbitration mechanism were, for at one point in time, the most popular international instrument that you might imagine. So these things started, well, they started back with the old treaties of friendship, commerce, and navigation. And the government of Germany, post-World War II, West Germany, got the idea of taking these and turning them into an investor protection agreement by adding an arbitration clause to it. The first one was in 1956. By the year 2000, there were over 2,500 in place. The World Bank created a facility for managing all these treaties called the ICSID, the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. Now, the ICSID Convention, which is basically an agreement to follow the rules that are set in this facility for the arbitrations and all the panels and everything, has 158 contracting states. That's nearly as many economies as the WTO. WTO has 164 members. So ICSID, which is one of two settlement facilities, has 158 contracting parties, popular. Now, among those 2,500 plus treaties that are still in force, over 1,000 of them have never had even a single case. So they're essentially dormant. It's a quiet little lawyer's issue. The politics got rough, at least in the United States, with the NAFTA. The NAFTA created cases where the United States was a respondent. The early treaties were basically, well, we called them bilateral investment treaties. They were really unilateral. The first one from the United States was with Egypt in 1985, that signed by USTR William Brock, former CSIS trustee. So they've been around for a while, but it was the NAFTA that led to cases being filed against the United States, often for state actions. And that caused some enough political chum to be tossed in the water that we spent the next decade or so amending treaties and restricting their utility for investors to the point that they're very little used now. Now, the politics soured in Europe soon after. Europe has, by the way, about half those total 2,500 treaties. A European sovereign is on one side or the other of those treaties. So lots of them involve European nations. But when Germany, their government, the Green Party in particular, decided to close nuclear power plants for some reason that may regret now, but that closure caused them to violate contracts. And the contracting party, I think whoever the firm was another European nation that was the headquarters of the firm. But they pursued action under a bilateral investment treaty. And the entire support in Europe for this treaty program just collapsed. So, you know, it's one of those things. The politics has always been tough to maintain. Nothing's really changed in terms of the utility of these agreements or the difficulty of winning. And over time, they're not used much by companies because they're kind of the last resort. But to portray them as sort of, oh, the poor little sovereign, they only expropriated that property because they needed the money, is kind of an insincere approach. Now, look, expropriation is a problem for international investment, even though a lot of countries want to attract international investment for their economic development. And this was a way to help them attract it by putting some protections in place. Expropriation happened in the past. It happens today. We just passed a major celebration in Mexico. March 18th. Those of you with Google, check what the national holiday is in Mexico on March 18th. It is Oil Expropriation Day. It's the day the Mexican government nationalized the oil industry. So this stuff happens. Things happen. And yet attracting foreign investment is seen as a good thing and seen as something beneficial to the country that attracts it. So the people who are complaining now about dispute settlement in CAFTA, they want to just erase that chapter, are the same people who talk about trade pauses and policy space and everything else. So it's hard to really defend what they're saying. But at the same time, the proponents are almost invisible on this. The opponents never really go away. And the proponents are kind of nervous and don't tend to speak up for the benefits of these programs, whether they're trade agreements in general or investment agreements like CAFTA Chapter 10.
Bill, in our proverbial green room before the recording, you told us you may have a rant about this as well, and I'm eager to hear it.
Well, it'll be a small one because Scott covered the issue very thoroughly. The point of these things in the beginning was for countries to protect their guys. The idea was that companies from mostly developed countries were investing overseas, and they were taking on the risk of expropriation, just as Scott mentioned. And the idea was to enter into treaties that would protect those companies from having that happen to them. And it would create, and these were reciprocal, so we had the same obligations in reverse. And for years, the public debate went the other way, went in favor of these things, because it was perceived as, this is a way to protect American equities in other countries. You know, it's protecting our guys. Then, for a variety of reasons, the debate, and this happened, I think, during the George W. Bush administration, but it's grown since then, the debate has now shifted because, as Scott mentioned, in NAFTA, there were a number of cases brought against the United States by Canada or Mexico, where we were the respondent and not the claimant or not the petitioner. And that created a current lobby of people saying, wait a minute, these procedures give foreigners rights inside the United States that we don't want them to have. They also argue that it gives them rights that American companies don't have, which I don't entirely agree with. So once the shoe was on the other foot and we were the defendant, the debate shifted a little bit, but the economic fundamentals haven't changed. We still invest abroad, and I think companies still welcome protections against expropriation or other unfair actions. What frustrates me a little bit is about the hypocrisy of this. And as we've said many times on The Trade Guys, there's no rule in trade against hypocrisy. And this is a good example of it, because this is the argument from the left wing is this is against big companies. You know, this is against large multinational companies that are investing overseas. And it's just visceral. They're big. We're against them. I'll say the one guy that was honest about this, I think, was Bob Lighthizer, who doesn't come from the left, to say the least. Lighthizer made this comment during the USMCA negotiations when we narrowed the scope of ISDS in that agreement. He said, why are we encouraging American foreign investment? I want them to invest in the United States. I don't want them to invest in other countries. And I think that's what this is really about. I mean, that's a legitimate policy argument, but Lighthizer was making, I think, the more accurate point, which is a lot of the people that dissent from the ISDS fundamentally don't want foreign investment. They want to force Americans to stay here. That's, I think, an anti-global growth position. It's an anti-jobs position. As we've also said many times on this, with 96% of the world's consumers outside our borders, we've got to reach out. If we don't reach out, we're doomed to be an even slower growth economy than we have been historically. So I don't think this is a productive path to follow. It was narrowed somewhat in ISDS, although typically on that one, politics intervened. It wasn't narrowed for the energy sector, as I recall. And the main reason it wasn't narrowed for the energy sector is at the time, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee was Kevin Brady from where? Texas.
Yes.
Politics is not out of the picture here, but Scott's right. It's kind of a small element of a small wart on the landscape, if you will. But it's fundamentally, I think, an anti-trade, anti-growth provision. and that it was originally put in for solid reasons. It's not good if you give the foreigners your money and then they expropriate. They take it away and they take your whatever it is you built there away and keep it for themselves. There's a fundamental act of fairness here.
You know, in this case, both sides could be wrong. USTR Lighthizer, when in office, characterized this provision as government-sponsored risk insurance for outsourcers, which was both harsh and untrue. For instance, you look at the record in the NAFTA, it's a lot of small businesses. In fact, the first case against the United States that I believed should have been where the investor should have won, where they really received awful treatment, was the Lowen case against the state of Mississippi.
One of my favorites.
Lowen was a family-owned funeral home company, literally a family business in Canada that tried to invest in the United States and got a dose of Mississippi justice. And by the time this thing was over, even the governor of Mississippi said this is really bad. So, but the idea that it's somehow protecting big outsourcers, Lighthizer was just wrong on the facts. One of my favorite cases was S.D. Myers. S.D. Myers was a small Ohio-based waste processing company that had a contract with Ontario for waste processing in their EPA-approved facility in the United States. And in the House of Parliament in Ottawa, the environment minister named Sheila Copps stood up and said, these are jobs that should be done by Canadians in Canada. So it was a Buy Canada argument that she made. It was a Canada First argument. And she was wrong. And Canada violated the obligations they had under the NAFTA for equitable treatment and national treatment for American investors like S.D. Myers, who was outsourcing nothing. They were importing waste and processing it. So it's one of those things. You gotta look beyond the rhetoric. But still, this is a little wildebeest at the back of the trade herd that tends to be preyed upon by anybody who's hungry. And so, but it has few defenders, which makes the persistence and consistency of the critics somewhat frustrating.
Guys, let's get into our second story, one that's close to home, especially for Bill, given his years in Baltimore. I'm, of course, talking about the city's Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse, a catastrophe given the presumed passing of six construction workers, but also an event that may hold consequences for trade. Guys, can you tell me a little more about the incident? What is the impact on the city's maritime commerce infrastructure?
Well, it had a personal impact on me in a way because I was driving to Philadelphia that day when it happened. I wasn't going to go that way on that route. And that's one of the side notes of this. At least one press report said this is going to have an adverse impact on road traffic north to south on 95. It for the most part, doesn't because that particular road is a long way. If you're moving along, you're going to take one of the tunnels that goes underneath the harbor. You would not take the Francis Scott Key Bridge. If your cargo is hazardous material, which isn't allowed in the tunnels, then you're going to go. You could go around the other way. I mean, you've got options. So I think in a lot of respects, this is, I mean, it's a terrible thing. And these people lost their lives, which is a terrible tragedy. And it's going to be expensive to deal with. The biggest economic impact is going to be on the automobile supply chain, because Baltimore is the 17th largest port in the country, but is the biggest port in the country for what's called ro-ro traffic, roll on, roll off. So if you're shipping cars and trucks here in these enormous container ships, well, they're not container ships, they're ships full of cars. We watched one go by on the Chesapeake and whatever it's called, canal, the one that goes up to Philadelphia. Baltimore is the first place in the nation for those 750,000 vehicles offloaded last year, including Nissan, Toyota, GM, Volvo, Jaguar, Land Rover, Volkswagen, which also includes Audi, Lamborghini, probably weren't very many of them, and Bentley is also probably not very many of them. It's also the largest U.S. port for farm and construction machinery, as well as a lot of agricultural products, including fertilizers and sugar and salt. So there's going to be disruptions. There are also, there are alternatives. It's a bit of a choke point, but it's not a fatal choke point. There's Philadelphia, New York, and New Jersey to the north. There's Norfolk to the south. And so what will happen is that companies will do what they always do when there's an emergency, which is they'll adjust. The cruise lines that have been going in and out of Baltimore, which I think there were three, Norwegian, Carnival, and Royal Caribbean, they'll find other ports, probably Norfolk. And the cargo will find other ports. I think the Ro-Ro cargo, the cars, will be a little bit more difficult because not every place is equipped to handle the volume that Baltimore was handling. So if you're in the market for a Lamborghini, you might find a longer delay in getting one. But I don't think that's going to impact the overall economy. I think also, don't assume that the port is closed because you can't get, because of all the debris. Don't assume it's going to be closed until they rebuild the bridge. You know, the Port of Baltimore functioned for more than 200 years without a bridge. And rebuilding the bridge is going to take a long time. Clearing the debris is going to take a while too, but that's measured in months, not years. So they'll get rid of the debris. They'll move the container ship that ran into the piling. They'll remove the girders and all the foundational stuff, and then the port will reopen. So it's going to be a dislocation for a few months, but I think that then after that, normal commerce will resume. People that use that route for commuting will continue to have a problem. And there was a number of companies, including some of the car companies, that had warehouses and storage facilities north of the bridge, and that means they're kind of off by themselves now because they won't be able to access the port without taking the long way around, which will be complicated for them. So inconvenient, yes. Very difficult in autos, yes. Fatal for the large economy, no.
You know, maritime transport is essential to international trade, and it has been since the days of sailing ships. So that's not a surprise. We also kind of talk about this issue a lot on the program. I was noting we had a couple discussions on the famous Ever Given, the container ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal. We had to wait till a high tide with a full moon to get enough water underneath it to refloat the ship and get it out of the way. We talked about the drought and its effect on the Panama Canal. We talked about the Houthis and their target practice in the Red Sea and the Suez. And we talked about the way COVID slowed supply chains, slowed the turn, and the Trans-Pacific transport took about twice as long for a round trip, sort of Shanghai to Long Beach to Shanghai, because of the disruptions caused by the pandemic. So this happens a lot. It's a reminder that specialization happens throughout the supply chain, including at ports. And Baltimore is clearly specialized in auto transport. So that's probably the sector to look for. Specialization is really good until it fails, and then you need resilience. But I think you'll get back to a point where the specialization, it has too many benefits to say that business is going to be gone for any long period of time. I think they'll find a way to restore it pretty quickly, not just because of the berths for the ships, but it's the services and facilities they have that allow that to be most efficient at that port. They'll need to sort of restructure so they can get it back in business. Apparently, Sparrow's Point, you could offload at Sparrow's Point, which is in the outside of the harbor, and still connect by road to the lots and the storage areas for vehicles. So there are not a lot of options, and there'll be a lot of creativity in getting back to work.
One of the interesting questions that I think people will be writing about with respect to the bridge and rebuilding it is, and one person has already mentioned this, is it even possible to build a bridge that will withstand what happened to the Francis Scott Key Bridge? When you have, this particular ship was containing 4,700 containers. It's a big, heavy ship. And the piling that it ran into simply couldn't withstand the shock. And some people have raised the question of, is it really possible to build a bridge that can when you've got container ships that are that big? And this wasn't the biggest. The biggest one that came into Baltimore was one that could hold 15,000 containers. So this was like a third of that. And imagine if it had been if you can do it with 4,700 containers, you can probably do more damage with 15,000. So there may be a lot of thought going into, what do we rebuild the bridge? I mean, the bridge is was built, what, in the late 70s. It's not been there forever. And it'll be interesting to see how they decide to go forward. The president has committed federal money to do it. The state of Maryland has a rainy day fund, capital fund of $2 billion, as I recall. And I think the legislature is, if it hasn't done it already today, is voting to make some of that money available for bridge reconstruction. So I think the money will be there to do that. But there is an engineering question of, you know, whether it's really possible, and do you want to create another bridge that will inevitably be vulnerable to the same problem?
Guys, closing this episode out with another topic that's highlighting autos in a completely different way. China filed a WTO complaint against the United States over what it says are discriminatory requirements for EV subsidies. Guys, why is China suing the United States at the WTO for supposed discriminatory trade practices?
Well, once again, for the second time today, proving that there's no rule against hypocrisy, because they're complaining about exactly the same thing that they do. And so, and in fact, the EU is investigating them for doing the same thing when it comes to electric vehicles. So all the sinners are accusing each other of sinning. One of the things that I think people may have missed in at least the early conversation about this is that several people have noted, well, you know, it doesn't really matter anymore because the WTO dispute settlement system is broken. And if we lose, as we well could, and I'll get to that in a minute, if we lose, the U.S. will just again appeal into the void, the non-existent appellate body. The thing that people need to keep in mind, which is hypothetical, but the U.S. and the other WTO nations have committed at the 12th ministerial and then discussed this again at the 13th ministerial, they're committed to addressing that problem by the end of this year. Now, they've blown through deadlines before, so they may blow through this one as well. But one needs to keep in mind, whatever trade action ensues from this Chinese request, it's not going to be solved till next year, because any process involved takes months, if not years. So it's entirely possible that the appellate body system and the dispute settlement system might be back up and running by the time this case comes to a conclusion, and we won't be able to appeal into the void, and we'll have to live with the consequences. Now, that said, it's going to be a while. What the Chinese did this week was make a request for consultation, which under WTO rules is the first step. And the United States can reject that request once. You know, the dispute settlement body in the WTO meets monthly, usually near the end of the month. So we can reject it once, but the second time we can't reject it. So the process will start. There's a consultation period. I think it's 60 or 90 days. And if that doesn't end with a satisfactory resolution, and in this case, it certainly won't, because we're talking about something that's in law, not just something the administration can change with a presidential order, then China can go ahead and file a complaint. And then there's a panel, and then they'll get probably at least a year to adjudicate this. I consulted somebody who's more expert on this than I am today about this. And there's two ways to argue the Chinese complaint. They can make the complaint that the subsidies are WTO consistent, and they can argue that the subsidies are discriminatory specifically against China. And they are, because they're designed in the EV case. This is an argument about the tax credits that are in the IRA, and particularly the electric vehicle tax credits. And they do discriminate against China because they say explicitly no Chinese materials, you know, no Chinese parts and components can be used if you want to be eligible for the tax credit. So on that point, we're on weak ground. On the larger point of whether the subsidies themselves are WTO illegal, I think you can make a good case that we're also on weak ground on that one. The WTO rules against export subsidies. That is a subsidy that says, we'll give you money if you export, which is not this. But also the WTO rules against import substitution subsidies are pretty good and pretty clear and pretty strong. And this is really an import substitution subsidy. It's designed to create domestic supply and thereby effectively preventing foreign supply. So I think you can argue, I mean, I don't think it's a slam dunk. It depends upon the arguments that are put forward and the arguments the U.S. puts forward. But, you know, it's reasonable to expect that this is a case we might well lose. And if you ask me, if we're smart, we'll bring the same case against the Chinese and they'll lose too. And then we'll see what happens.
You know, this is one where I think the WTO dispute is the part of the iceberg that's above the waterline. The whole iceberg is the global auto market, which, because of geopolitics, at least the battery-powered electric vehicle market, which is global as well, is splitting into China and non-China in terms of exports and domestic production. What you have at the moment is both the largest market for sales and production for battery-powered electric vehicles is China. That's an unusual situation. But with that, with electric vehicles, you got to start thinking about China as the Detroit of these kinds of vehicles. And manufacturers, including Japanese and German and American manufacturers, produce in China. And there are some vehicles they can export from China to other countries who welcome them. There are some places where China's exports will be prohibited. And there's some gray areas in between. But this is a subject where basically a global business called the global auto business, at least it's the battery electric share of that, has to deal with the geopolitics of all the materials and the content of the car. It's complicated. It's messy because even electric vehicles have a lot of components. There was a manufacturer who I think I think Volkswagen had imported some vehicles for sale in the United States and had to cancel the sale because they contained some Chinese components that were prohibited. So it's going to be complicated and messy, but the key is this is not an American business that China has a small share of. It's a global business where China maybe is the leading producer and leading trader in the segment.
If that's the iceberg, are you saying that auto consumers are the proverbial Titanic?
But I don't know. I got to think about that, Debo. That's a good question. Well, I got the 90-10 equivalent about what's under the waterline, but I'm not sure who the ship is that's about to run into this.
Well, we've had a large ro-ro container
that's about to plow into the side of this iceberg. So I'm not sure that analogy goes in much further.
And we're getting into deep water here. Probably we should.
Yes, definitely.
Well, that will be waters to tread for another podcast on the Trade Guys. Guys, thank you so much for this episode. I'll see you another week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.